On America Can We Talk, I talk about election integrity, border security, healthcare freedom, race relations, energy and tax policy, education policy, free speech and assembly, freedom of religion, and all other issues that touch on the God-given right of every American to life, liberty, and the pursuit of their version of happiness. Stay tuned.
You preach your tolerance, but lecture me. Is there no end to your own hypocrisy? Your God is power, you have no shame. Your only interest is political gain. You hide your eyes and refuse to listen. You play your game.
Coming up next, America Can We Talk with your host, Debbie Georgiatos.
And hello and welcome to America Can We Talk and to one of our very special Thursday shows. Thank you so very much for tuning in to America Can We Talk today. We have a very special guest in studio today, which just is going to be a wonderful discussion. Her name is Dr. Mary Talley Bowden. And many of you are thinking, I think I've heard that name before. I have mentioned her on our show before. She is a Texan. She's a Houston-based doctor, and she has been among the most brave, clear-thinking doctors around the country in trying to handle what all of us experience as the COVID crisis over the last, or I began to call it the COVID episode, which has happened over the last several years. She has an amazing story to tell, and I will very quickly introduce her. She completed her residency at Stanford University, and she's a board certified in, I'm going to ask her how to pronounce the word, but basically, she is an ear, nose, and throat person. I try to learn how to pronounce this word. I don't think I'll try. But in any case, she's a specialist in ear, nose, and throat. She's a Houston doctor. She has been working to help people, especially with breathing problems, as an ear, nose, and throat doctor, and had a great deal of involvement in what happened in the Houston medical community and the Texas Medical Board to deal with COVID and its effects on citizens. So please welcome to the show, Dr. Mary Talley Bowden. Okay, I'm going to take one shot at this word. Otolaryngology.
Close. Otolaryngology.
Say it again.
Otolaryngology.
Why don't they make a simpler word? That's like too hard a word.
I know. I actually love it, though.
Because you know how to say it.
I know. Yes. It's a challenge.
Okay. In any case, you're an ear, nose, and throat specialist. And I just want to have you spend just a minute talking about what it takes to get there as a doctor. I mean, you had undergrad. I mean, the episode to get you through to where your life, to get you to where you were a certified specialist.
It's not easy. It's 13 years of higher education. My residency was 5 years, and I often joke it was like a prison sentence. It was the hardest 5 years of my life, physically and emotionally. You're up all night. You're just dealing with an enormous amount of stress, and you're getting paid next to nothing while you're doing it as well. So it is grueling. It's very hard. You have to make straight A's throughout your education.
You know, you mentioned something we were talking earlier today about, and it should be this way, I guess, overall. In your medical training, you are basically taught, here's what the situation is. You're taught protocols to follow. Can you talk about this just a moment as doctors are trained, what that means to say there are protocols that are taught?
Well, there's standards of care, which you need. I mean, you can't, there are things that are just accepted as, okay, this is what you do for this sort of disease, and this is how most people would treat it. That being said, there should be room for thinking outside the box, especially in light of a new disease where, you know, people really don't know how to deal with it. There shouldn't be hard set protocols in place for something that we've never seen before.
Well, that sounds fair. So you came to Texas in, is it 2003 or 4?
2003.
Mm-hmm. And so you practiced for a while in doing just in a private practice of ear, nose, and throat. Correct?
Correct.
Just you yourself, or you had partners?
With two other ENTs. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's actually amazing. I don't think I've ever been to an ear, nose, and throat doctor, but I mean, that's a full-time, people who have challenges with breathing are, that's their thing. Okay, so you also formed in 2019, we're gonna get to COVID very quickly, but in 2019 you organized a group, you created a group called Breathe MD. like B-R-E-A-T-H-E, Breathe MD in 2019. What was the point of that?
So I took time off. I have four kids, and I took time off to raise the kids, and then I decided I was going to go back to work, and I'm really questioning that decision now, but six months before the pandemic, I started a solo practice, just specializing in ENT, and I just stumbled into COVID, and here we are.
So that was just a practice dedicated to that. Okay, so you know, I want to just start down the COVID path with you then. We have many, many things I want to have you cover. And I was telling you before the show, to me, the reason to have these kind of shows, to have this discussion, it's about, you know, whether or not we have respect for healthcare freedom, whether we have respect for the doctor-patient relationship, whether doctors are respected by the system in their practice of medicine. And I find your story truly amazing. So let's just launch. So COVID starts, and in your practice, you're already practicing ENT. I'm gonna call it that instead of that long word, ENT. And so you're doing that. What were the first things that happened in your practice that, I mean, obviously you became aware because the whole nation did, but in your practice when COVID came to your attention?
Well, I'm a neighborhood ENT. I'm well located. I'm easy to get into where my office is situated. So I end up seeing a lot of people with just colds and strep throat and sort of acute problems. And so then I started seeing the patients with COVID. And one of the things I treat is chronic sinusitis. And chronic sinusitis can be challenging because a lot of people are given a bunch of different antibiotics. You don't know which to treat them with. And I had a lab that I was working with that had a PCR test for bacterial and fungal infections for sinusitis. No one knew what PCR was back then. Now we've all heard of it. But they came out with a saliva test for COVID, a PCR saliva test for COVID. And because of where my practice is located, it was great. People could just pull up, we'd hand them a cup. They would spit in their cup in the car and then leave it outside. So it was contact free. And, you know, early on, it was very hard to get results back in a timely fashion. It was taking 2 weeks for people to get their COVID results back because LabCorp was slammed. So we were able to get results back the next day. And so my little office just exploded because we were the only place in town where you could get COVID results quickly. And then they turned positive, and we'd have these long conversations. You know, it was like giving out a death sentence almost. And I'd say, go to your primary care doctor. And they'd come back to me and say, well, my primary care doctor said, just wait and go to the emergency room if you can't breathe. I mean, all the primary care doctors shut their offices down, which was unbelievable. So, I mean, that didn't sit well for me. And I didn't know what to do. I just started offering breathing treatments. And we talked about Dr. Bartlett, and initially I did them in my office, but I started getting so much heat. I ordered battery operated nebulizers. And so we did breathing treatments in people's cars. I'd give them antibiotics and steroids as I saw fit. And early on that was pretty successful. And then monoclonal antibodies came out. So I started offering monoclonal antibodies, and those were amazing. I mean, people would turn around in 24 hours. And I had unlimited supply. I could go straight to the manufacturer, order as many as I wanted, and boom, they'd be there the next day. Well, then the government took over distribution of monoclonal antibodies, and they became rationed, and they became hard to get. And that's when I started using ivermectin, because I had to have all these patients coming to me sick, and it was running out of monoclonal antibodies. And that's sort of how I got into ivermectin. And I found out that ivermectin worked just as well. Not as quickly, I would say. You know, monoclonal antibodies, people wake up the next day and feel amazing. Not all the time, but for the most part. And ivermectin might have taken a little bit longer, but that in combination with other medications worked very well. And, you know, I haven't counted in a while, but the last time I counted, I had 5,500 patients alive and well. Because of early treatment.
5,500 COVID patients, and they all recovered alive and well.
No one's died.
Okay, I do it, yeah. That is a great thing. I want to go back and be clear about something. When you're talking about these breathalyzer, right? Well, that's not what it's called.
Breathing treatments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Were you doing that with just, what was in it? Was it just?
Budesonide. And sometimes albuterol, but yeah, the steroids.
So steroids, and you were, before all of this, before you got to ivermectin, you did that because it was just a way to, you knew it to be a way that opened lung passages.
I was trying to use common sense as a doctor, right?
You'd heard of it before, budesonide. Yeah. Yeah, you'd heard of the whole, you knew what it was.
Yeah.
Okay. So when you got around to using ivermectin, I want to focus on ivermectin for a minute. Had you, prior to the time you began prescribing ivermectin for COVID patients, had you ever prescribed it before in any?
No, I mean, I'd heard of it, but barely heard of it. And I researched it. I mean, I didn't trust anybody. I went back to the FDA original approval documents. I went back to the FDA website, I looked at ivermectin, I looked at the safety data, and one of the key benchmarks is the LD50. And that tells you, okay, you give, what dose of a medication will kill 50% of lab rats or mice or whatever they're using? And so that's a benchmark number to see how dangerous a drug is. And the dosage for ivermectin, it varies in which animals they test, but it's anywhere from 60 times to 400 times the amount that we're prescribing. So that told me that, you know, even though we're prescribing a higher dose than what they're giving for parasites, that I was still way below any safety concerns. I also searched to see about overdose reports, suicide, could not find anything on ivermectin. Whereas if you looked up Tylenol, people, you know, there are plenty of reports of people overdosing and dying from Tylenol.
I never knew that, from Tylenol. Okay, you sent me something earlier and I won't read the whole long fact sheet, but what I'm getting at before we continue down this discussion is, when you decided these patients who were, once monoclonal antibodies became difficult for you to get, you turned to people who are coming in with COVID and treating with ivermectin, you researched it before you even started down the path of assuming ivermectin could help.
Oh yeah.
COVID patients. And so you got information from the FDA, which, and I don't know, is that what you sent me, this fact sheet?
Well, that's not from the FDA. I created that fact sheet, but
okay. Well, approved for human use since 1987. And now that you have learned about ivermectin, what was the purpose of ivermectin being prescribed back in 87?
A disease called river blindness in Africa, but I mean, it's been given to over 4 billion people worldwide at this point.
Okay, so 1987 has been around since then, so it wasn't a brand new concoction, mm-hmm. and it had been used. I actually read about that river blindness, and it was an amazing turnaround mm-hmm. for people who otherwise were very traumatically impacted. Mm-hmm. And so ivermectin, viewed as safe, been administered more than 4 billion times. It's on the World Health Organization's list of essential medications. Mm-hmm. So it was not a new thing.
Mm-mm, no. Okay. Time-tested.
Time-tested, for sure. It's also not very expensive.
Right.
Because the
patents... Well, until COVID came around. Then the insurance companies stopped paying for it. And so it became a lot more expensive than it should have been.
But ivermectin was the patent had lapsed, mm-hmm. correct? And mm-hmm. so it isn't the problem with really expensive drugs that there's still a patent and so
right,
the price
exactly.
is higher. Okay, so you've got ivermectin, you're rolling along. And in your practice, by the way, so you do surgery sometimes?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You do surgery in your practice or where in your building where your practice is or at the hospital? Or where
at an outpatient surgery center.
Outpatient surgery, okay. So these folks are coming in, and I assume everyone in the medical community was really excited because you were having people who were getting over or getting treated well by you.
Yeah,
well, no,
I know.
Actually, that was a joke question, but I'm serious. What was the reaction of the medical community?
Oh, no, it was, you know, I was shut down from the start. You know, these Facebook groups that are, neighborhood Facebook groups kicked me off their Facebook group. You know, I was very open. I was trying to, I'd put all my results on my website. I would post my results on Instagram. I would, and I would get shut down. I was either fear-mongering or I was underestimating the disease, or I just couldn't win.
And this is all happening in 2020 before the vaccines came along?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So before the vaccines, when everybody else was just kind of afraid and cowering and maybe staying home waiting for the vaccines, you're providing something that actually helped people get better.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's good. That's your job. Okay, so then I want to keep, I'm amazed someone of your caliber and your education really didn't have more, what you think normally would happen, would other doctors be calling and say, hey, wait, I'm hearing this is going well. Maybe I'll try. Was that happening at all?
None at all. And I was actually very surprised at the breathing treatments that I had a way of doing, because people were so, the hospitals wouldn't even give breathing treatments because they thought it would aerosolize the virus. So I thought, well, here, we can do them in people's cars. They were cheap. It was $50 to get a breathing treatment in your car. And I thought that would, people would, I'd get referrals from a bunch of doctors, but no, not at all.
I find that astonishing because it seems to me medicine, as any other endeavor, but really medicine, especially something unknown and alarming like COVID-19 was, people would be looking around. Medical professionals would be looking for other people saying, you know, what are you finding that works? But that didn't happen.
No. In fact, they just labeled me as a grifter, that I was just trying to take advantage of people. That was how it was spun. Mm-hmm.
And actually, again, it's not a very, you weren't making tons of money with this medication, correct?
No. I mean, nothing off of ivermectin at all, no.
Okay. So, fast forwarding, so you go through that episode, you ended up getting, you must have had privileges at Houston Methodist, mm-hmm. correct?
Right.
Okay. So you eventually ran into trouble with Houston Methodist, and privileges meaning you're allowed to practice medicine in there. You can prescribe for people who are there in the hospital.
Right.
So, okay.
Yeah.
So what happened with Houston Medical?
And I never stepped foot in that hospital. You know, I do outpatient surgery, tubes, tonsils, that sort of thing. I rarely have to admit a patient, but just had those privileges as a just in case. So I'd never stepped foot in that hospital. I felt very loosely tied to them. Houston Methodist was the first hospital in the country to mandate the vaccine. They did it before the government, you know, it was June of 2021. So they prided themselves on this vaccine mandate. I kept seeing patients testing positive who were vaccinated and just as sick, if not sicker. I didn't see that the vaccine was working. I was seeing patients with side effects. Plus, I knew that early treatment was very effective. So I started speaking out on Twitter about the vaccine mandates being wrong. I had so many people very distraught, trying to choose between their jobs and getting this shot that had no long-term safety data. I think 2 days before they went after me, I tweeted 25 times. I wrote, vaccine mandates are wrong, with a patient testimonial. And I did that 25 times. The next thing I knew, they were attacking me on social media. They suspended my privileges, and the way I found out is I got a text message from a reporter at the Houston Chronicle. That's how I found out that my privileges were suspended. And then they went on Twitter and did a thread, which is a series of tweets, and in that thread said I was spreading dangerous misinformation that was harmful to the community. Subsequently, I was swarmed with media requests, reporters. It was a big mess.
And this is occurring middle of 2021.
This was November 2021 when that all went down.
Okay. And the only reason they were provoked by you or that in your interaction with them was because of content of tweets, which they were claiming were somehow unjustified, were dangerous.
Right. I'm speaking out against the vaccine mandates.
Okay. Were you also speaking out at that point about ivermectin in your tweets?
Yes, but you know, I was pretty careful back then, not so much now, but back then I said things like ivermectin works. Yeah, I was pretty cautious, but I still said yes.
Okay, so you find out they've suspended your privileges, plus it's a very public thing to do for them to put that out on Twitter.
It's not how it's normally handled.
How's it normally handled?
Normally handled, maybe a phone call, maybe a private meeting. I'm not aware of any hospital ever going after a doctor like this in such a public fashion.
Okay, so they went after you by publicly tweeting, by the way, we've suspended her privileges, and describing your treatment as dangerous. So what happened next? I mean, do you contact them to say, what are you doing, or what happens next?
This happened on a Friday. On Monday, I found a lawyer, and then I, with the lawyer's help, drafted my resignation letter. And then subsequently, they reported me to the medical board for resigning under investigation. So I'm dealing with that now.
And you resigned just because if that's how they're going to treat you, you don't
exactly.
want to be affiliated.
Exactly. Like, I want nothing to do with you.
Okay. So that caused them to report you to the medical board. This is the Texas medical board.
Right.
And that Texas medical board has the power to take your license away. Is that true?
Right. Yes.
They take your license away. They can suspend your license. They can make you go to classes to... you know, like concentration camp, relearn the truth, yeah.
And the public shaming. If you get sanctioned by the medical board, there's an email blast that goes out to all the doctors. It's on their website. It's on a permanent record. So.
Okay. So Texas Medical Board. So this is the one interaction you started on that path with Texas Medical Board, Houston Methodist having suspended privileges and then turned you in for this. Okay, so I'm going to get to your Texas Medical Board interactions in just a moment. So we have that one going on. There was another case I kind of want to get turned to now what's happened with the medical board. You talked about another instance is a case involving you in front of the Texas Medical Board. Mm-hmm. Can you tell about that one?
Yeah, so there was a man in Dallas, Texas Hughley Hospital. He, father of six, sheriff's deputy, Jason Jones, you may have heard of him in the media. And his wife reached out to me because he'd been in a coma on a ventilator for over a month. The hospital had sort of given up, and she wanted him to have ivermectin. So she had a lawyer because the hospital refused, and they were filing a case against the hospital, and they needed me to provide, you know, to be the doctor on the other side, the doctor that would prescribe the ivermectin and just, you know, support them. So I agreed and submitted a prescription and testified on his behalf.
We testified in a court.
You know, as the expert witness saying, this is what I would recommend. And, you know, he's dying. There's no other, they've tried everything. They run out of options. And the wife, which should be her right, wanted to try ivermectin. And I was willing to write the prescription and stand behind them and testify. We won the court. We won the case, and the judge ordered that they grant me temporary privileges and then write the order as having privileges. It's quite an arduous process getting privileges. There's all sorts of things you have to submit, but I went through it, and then they denied my privileges, which I have.
This is, again, this Hughley Hospital here.
Yes.
Okay.
So I have a clean record. I don't have any malpractice cases. Until recently, have good reputation. And so they denied my privileges very arbitrarily. And so there was a lot of, you know, delay tactics back and forth. They finally got the privileges approved. And then they immediately appealed. But we were told that we could do the ivermectin anyway. I found a nurse willing to go into the hospital and give it to them. She shows up at the hospital, and she is greeted by the administrators and police officer. And the police officer was told by the administrator that if the nurse is allowed to give the ivermectin, that it would kill the patient. And so the police officer stopped the nurse, and she had to leave. And then the next day, the appeal went through, and we lost on appeal. So he never was allowed to get the ivermectin.
Okay. So this gentleman,
and then the hospital turned me in to the medical board for fighting for him.
Yes. Okay. Exactly. I was gonna get it. So this is the next thing. The medical board is the hospital complaining of your involvement, even though you only were involved because the wife asked you, "Can you please help us try to get ivermectin to him?"
Right. Correct. And the lawyer was guiding us through the whole thing as well.
Yeah. I mean, a very legal process.
Right.
Yeah. And so you had the wife, the lawyer, and you on the side of trying to get this guy ivermectin. What was the reason, if you know, what was the hospital's argument why he couldn't get ivermectin?
What is anybody's argument? It's safe. I mean, even if you could say, okay, it doesn't work, well, there's plenty of data showing that it works. And even in the late stages, they've shown that it has a 46% chance of saving somebody's life in the late stages of COVID. So, but regardless, it was safe, right? And he's dying, and there's no other options. So
and he's dying of COVID or from COVID?
Well, the aftermath of COVID, right?
Okay.
At that point, he's, you know, the COVID's probably not the issue. It's all the other stuff.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, at that point, one of the stories I read about this case was saying that the hospital is actually talking to his wife about getting hospice, setting up
right,
hospice.
Exactly.
So he's at that point. He's that
right.
point diminishment. So the hospital, I'm sorry to repeat the question, but did they offer some reason why ivermectin was not permissible?
I don't recall their exact argument, but you know, it's the same old thing. You know, Methodist said that saying that ivermectin works was like telling the public to swallow bleach, and which is absurd. I mean, it's just this, and that's brings us to why I'm suing the FDA, because the FDA has painted ivermectin as, you know, a horse drug. You know, they branded ivermectin as not suitable or safe for human consumption, which is completely false.
Satellite phones have been wiped out globally because of the supply chain collapse and war in Europe. But a truly amazing new option has emerged, the BiviStick, which allows you to send and receive text messages using almost any mobile device without relying on cell towers at all. In a world where war, riots, or a power grid failure can happen literally at any time, The Bivy Stick and its two-way satellite messaging gives you the power to reach loved ones, to send emergency messages, or request a rescue. And to use this device, you do not have to register your name, and you don't need to turn on location services or reveal your geographic location. The battery life is several days in duration, and you can easily recharge it using a small portable power bank. There are only about 20,000 Bivy Sticks that will be available in America this year. Get yours now while they're still available at SAT123.com. That's SAT123.com. SAT123.com. They have put together a really incredible package: emergency backup communication systems, power systems. We've got sat phones. We've got solar panels and also the big 400 watt solar panel behind us there. And why does this matter? Because of course, right now we are dealing with massive risk of blackouts, and the power grid is just failing, you know, intermittently, but it's going to get worse because we've also got energy shortages. Think about the lack of coal power, the diesel problems that are happening right now. If you're in the military or the National Guard or Border Patrol or law enforcement, and you need to be able to function even when the power grid goes down, or maybe you're a first responder, rescue team, firefighter, paramedic, you name it, you need to know about this equipment. So SAT123.com, folks.
I feel that Juvent is helping me to get better every day in every way.
That impact is what has been shown to help improve your bone density. Without that impact, you're missing a very important nutrient in your physical conditioning program.
The Juvent Micro Impact System allows the person to create more joint range of motion. Now I know there's a chance that nourishment can take place to that joint.
Get one of these.
You know, the obvious in really any arena of life, when things are so inexplicable otherwise, they're just so illogical and seemingly rapidly being pursued, the common mantra is follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. Is it your sense that what's occurring in these hospitals and doctors, is it in part the biopharmaceutical money making its way to the hospitals, making its way to the FDA and the CDC, NIH? Is that part of the problem? The big biopharmaceutical conglomerates locking hands with the federal agents that I just mentioned?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big conglomerate is a perfect term for it. They're all in bed together. They're all, you know, getting kickbacks from one another. I mean, it's a mess, and it's a big mess. But you know, we what's amazing is that there's so much money poured at censoring people like me. So much money has been poured into these groups to come after us, and yet we've still gotten the message out. And only 17% of people have gotten the last vaccine or the last booster. Means that, you know, we're getting out there, even though we don't have all that money behind us.
Yeah. There are many people who have been looking at this whole COVID episode and questioning, I'm not asking you to firmly say you agree or disagree, but questioning whether it was orchestrated. And we had a guest a few weeks ago on the show, Mark Fulmer, mm-hmm. Who is a bioterrorism researcher, guru kind of guy, who wrote a book about COVID-19, the whole idea that it was as a bioweapon, it was released on purpose. He talked about the apparent planned effort to release the COVID-19 and to plan the entire reaction. I mean, I don't know if you want to comment whether you think that's true or not.
I think, you know, your husband made an excellent point, is if this were a novel virus that would just hit us, blindsided us, why was everybody so closed-minded about alternative treatments, right?
Yes.
Why were they from the start shutting us down and muzzling us and attacking anybody that went against the narrative. If it were really something that blindsided us, right, you would think that they would be interested in any and all treatments or avenues of tackling it. So I think that is a strong case to be made that maybe this was, there was more to it than we realized.
Yeah. I used to ask these questions of any doctors on the show. I say very quickly, do masks in any way help stop the spread of viruses?
No.
There was any reason in this particular virus to do the mask thing?
No. Other than to symbolize compliance.
Exactly. Symbolize compliance. That's a great way. That's a polite way to say it. And so, and was there any science behind the idea of social distancing, keep 6 feet apart?
No, absolutely ridiculous.
So there was no science behind the mask, no science behind social distancing. How about the whole, you know, shutting down the society, the economy, the churches, the businesses? Was that justified?
No, absolutely not.
So we had a massive movement, and really, whether you want to point to NIH and Anthony Fauci or whoever you want to point to up there, that mindset that said we're going to do all these things, it didn't just happen in a small cabal in Washington. It spread out through most of the states, through most of the medical boards, through state-level officials, through county-level officials. I mean, people with authority to use force, to demand that people behave a certain way. And I'm kind of amazed that there weren't more doctors. There should be more doctors like you willing to question. So actually, what has happened to the doctors?
Well, because look what they did to me. I mean, I was not a key figure at Methodist Hospital. They went after me for a reason. They used me to set an example. This is what's going to happen if you come out against the hospital or come out against the government, right? I have all these people attacking me online, and we find out that they're actually funded by, you know, in back channels by the CDC.
And I'd love to have you talk about that. You mentioned at lunch. Yeah, talk a little more about that. The CDC, what they're doing.
So there's these groups, Team Halo, Shots Heard, and they're like young, hip doctors that are social media influencers that go out there and try to brainwash the public about the vaccine. And they call themselves the Digital Calvary. And they encourage the public to report people like me to the medical board. I have all these fake reviews on my Google business account saying that I'm a murderer and all this other business. But they weaponize social media to go after anybody that speaks out against the government.
And the CDC is funding some of these people.
CDC Foundation. I mean, they have it on their website. I mean, it's right there.
So this is your tax dollars at work.
Oh yeah.
By the way, so we're paying tax dollars to Washington to fund CDC to basically propagandize us.
Exactly.
You know, I end up a lot of times on the show saying, well, how do we fix this? What do we do to change this? I mean, there isn't one fix, obviously. It's a long term, but part of what occurred was the term has been used, I don't know if we talked about it, but regulatory capture, where the federal agencies were supposed to be the ones whose job to protect the American people, report information about diseases at CDC and FDA, approved drugs, but they have become whatever they started out as, are supposed to be regulating and keeping tabs on the private sector, the biopharmaceuticals, and the biopharmaceuticals seem to have captured those agencies, so they're now really working in the interests of the biopharmaceuticals instead of the American people. Do you think that's accurate?
Oh, yeah, the conflict of interest problem is the key thing. They're all
enormous.
You know, going from FDA to Pfizer to, you know, they're all hopping around, and you know, like I said earlier, they're all in bed together.
So how do we get out of this?
I wish I knew. I'm just trying to fight back the best I can, and maybe just expose them, right? A lot of exposure.
Exposure is a great answer. I'll tell you something else, and many people have been expressing this concern. Dr. Fauci wrote an article, and I didn't look it up again this morning, but it was pretty long ago, maybe in the late 90s or early 2000s. But he wrote an article about we are entering the era of pandemics.
Ugh.
I mean, and he talked about how it isn't just that, you know, and he, as everyone probably recognizes, he gave a speech, Fauci did, shortly before Donald Trump took office, saying there will be a pandemic during Donald Trump's. I mean, as though it was a known fact, like, you know, there might be a tornado that year. There will be a pandemic, and he wrote this piece about the era of pandemics being tied to another, what I think of as a hoax, is climate change. And climate change, you see, is going to cause this pandemic, you know, this tsunami of pandemics. So you get to feel like what we went through in responding to COVID is what we're going to have to be ready to deal with more than once. It's not going to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience. Do you feel concerned about that, that there are more viruses and pandemics coming down the road?
Well, I think the bright side of all of this is that if there is another pandemic, people are not going to, you know, jump in with both feet without questioning things. I mean, people are going to push back more, and, you know, maybe that's the tipping point, is the next pandemic, is that people are not going to put up with it after what's happened.
Let us hope. We're going to go to audience questions in a moment. There's a microphone over there. If you have a question, we ask you to raise your hand. And we love if you actually will get and stand in the middle and speak right in the microphone so everyone online can hear. And while she's turning, so where you stand, by the way, at Texas Medical Board, the upcoming next episode, you don't have a date yet, but they still could decide, based on these cases in front of you, to take your license away. Is that right?
Basically, they'll dole out their punishment, and if I don't comply with their punishment, they can take my license away. Just like what they did with Eric Henson. Have you heard about the mask?
So you have no hope that they will look through the whole hearing and say, never mind, charges drop. Do you no hope that that will happen?
I don't know what's going to happen, but I'm not going to fold, at least at this point.
You're not going to fold, darn right. Yep. Okay, we did have a question here. Go right ahead.
Well, I'm Carol Nichols, and thank you so much for your courage and your leadership. And the journey that you've walked, very similar to Dr. Yvette Lozano in Garland, also was persecuted by the Texas Medical Board. And I would say, based on my research, I think we now all know that the suppression of ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, it was all about the money in order to get those experimental vaccines approved. And so, being a retired banker, I mean, I do know it is about the money. There were billions of dollars made in this last fiasco. So I think it will be repeated. And so what I'd like to ask you is, what advice do you have for us on how we can access like-minded doctors like yourself here in Dallas or throughout the country when this comes upon us again? How do we access, because I know you're one of the few doctors that stood strong along with Dr. Lozano, and it's a small group. Most of them are family practitioners in small practices. Mm-hmm. All the big doctors sold out. I couldn't get my concierge doctor at Presbyterian Healthcare to prescribe anything. She said the same thing. Stay home till it gets worse, then go to ER.
Exactly.
And fortunately, I found Dr. Lozano. And so how will we access people like you when this happens again, and it will, through I've researched telemed options. Mm-hmm. I'm keeping a long file on telemed phone numbers to call doctors like you. What's the network? How do we tap into that?
That's a good question. I keep a list on my website of like-minded doctors in Texas. The FLCCC, Frontline Critical Care, they have a list of doctors. American Frontline Doctors has a list. And then there's a group of doctors in all 50 states that provide free telehealth services, and of course I'm blanking on the name right now, but you know, if you do a Google search, and you know, even I've had people on social media message me, where can I get a doctor, and I try to respond to that, but I think there's hope that you can access it in a pinch. And that's really the most common question I get from my patients is, who can I go to? Who can I trust? And I keep a list in my office that I hand them, and they love that, just having that peace of mind.
I know there's several other questions, but if I get time, I don't want you to answer, but just before I forget to say it, if you could write federal law, if you could run and tell Congress they had to pass it, the president had to sign it, what would you do to try to correct the situation in Washington? But don't answer it yet. Yeah. And say it in 1 minute. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead, please.
I'm really concerned about the Texas Medical Board. It seems to be a dangerous board. Who are these people on the board, and did Governor Abbott appoint them? Who appoints them?
Governor Abbott I don't know their names off the top of my head, but they are on the website. We have a wonderful Senator Bob Hall, who yesterday...
Yeah. We all know him, yeah.
And yesterday, he presented a bill, SB 666, trying to rein in the medical board. So they're trying to get that out of committee. He said that maybe today it'll get out of committee. Let's hope so. But I feel like he's sort of our only hope at this point.
Any way for any of us to have an impact on that?
I think contacting your legislators would be wonderful, right? If you could
to support Bob Hall's bill,
yes.
Senator Hall's bill,
SB 666.
Does he have a House version? Is there a House version? You don't know.
I'm not
okay.
Sure,
okay.
Have you had any experience with the pharmacy board?
I've reported a bunch of pharmacists because I get so triggered because, you know, I'll send my ivermectin prescriptions to Walgreens, CVS, all those, and they won't fill them. And so if I have time, I'll confront them. And if I have time, I'll report them to the pharmacy board. And I know I've made at least 15 reports. They've all been shut down.
Does the pharmacy board have the authority to, first of all, does a pharmacist have the right in Texas to say, I don't care what you want to prescribe, I won't do it? Does he have that right?
Well, because of the abortion pill, they do have that right to refuse, but they're misusing the intent of that law, right?
Sure, And does the pharmacy board, if you report them, what is their authority? Do they suspend him? Do they, him or her, they just say, unless you fulfill this, you're out, or what they do?
Well, so far they've done nothing, so I don't know what they would, you know, what their authority is.
This is the most, I'm sorry to sound like conspiracy theorists, it feels like a giant conspiracy against truth.
Yeah.
Just against truth and just against what doctors who practice medicine know. I mean, it's the most amazing thing. There was another, over there.
Thank you, Mary, for coming out here, and I appreciate what you're doing. Doesn't the law give you a lot of discretion in your prescribing decisions? And what would you say to those elected officials running for office? How can we rectify this problem such that doctors are given the autonomy to make the prescription choice they need to treat the patients?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, so many drugs are prescribed off-label, right? And prior to COVID, there was plenty of leeway. No one paid any attention to doctors prescribing drugs that were off-label. I know Senator Hall also has a bill addressing this issue. Same thing, just, you know, not going after a doctor for using a drug off-label. Protecting off-label drugs. So. Unfortunately, I mean, we shouldn't need any kind of legislation like that, but apparently we do. And we shouldn't, especially in Texas, we shouldn't need that, but.
That's for sure.
This is sort of a hard question to articulate and maybe hard to answer, but in medical school and then doctors that you've been known socially over the last few years since you've been in practice, have your relationships changed now? And with that, are there doctors who really thought in the beginning they really believed that they were doing the right thing by going along, but have changed their mind and said, wow, now I realize you were right, and I was just...
I wish. No, I mean, I was invited to a party last weekend, and I walked in and there was a doctor there, and I made an excuse and left because I knew they knew who I was, and I just didn't want to have that kind of, I didn't want it to be judged the whole time.
But do you think they still believe that they were right and you were wrong, or do you think they just...
They're certainly not admitting it to me if they do believe that. I don't know. I think they're...
Sad.
I don't know. I'm not having a lot of people coming forward and saying, no, you're right, you were right.
Interesting.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
I love this line of questioning. I see another hand, and I swear I'll make a really short point. It is so bizarre to think about, you know, over time, it seems doctors would have had disagreements. Like, you might have thought, well, always in this case, if the patient's over 70, I do this, or whatever it is, it would be in your head. And you would not expect everyone to agree with you, and other people wouldn't. But it wouldn't be a source of, and therefore I am canceling you, therefore I am rejecting you. But that cancel culture mindset has even gotten into the practice of medicine.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It's like mentally ill. I'm sorry. Please go ahead.
All right, you know, with the local cases you were involved in and other similar things I've heard about, where the patient, they've tried everything, they're suggesting hospice and everything, what happened to their right to try?
Exactly. Well, but that's for experimental drugs. So they use that technicality that, you know, if it's a tried and true medication, it doesn't count. I mean, it's completely bizarre.
Actually, you know, one other point I want to be sure and cover, because I this is something I didn't know. I read a lot to get ready for this interview, and I learned a lot. One was this lawyer who is assisting in your cases talked about working around the country, trying to bring the attention of the courts to these cases where someone's in the hospital and they're being denied ivermectin and the family wants them to have it. And the observation this lawyer made about the courts, tell that story.
Oh, yeah. And it's you amazing. May be better with the numbers on this, but I believe it was 180 cases they tried. And basically half the cases were presided by a Republican judge and half were presided by a Democrat judge. And the they won the cases, I think it was something like, if there were 90 cases, 88 out of 90 cases the patient lived if it was a Republican judge. All the cases that were presided over by a Democrat judge, they lost the case and the patient died. So it was basically the patient lived or died based on whether, on the political party of the judge.
Yeah, I will actually, I wish I had marked that data, but yeah, it's in exactly what you're saying. But again, it brings up the bizarreness of how COVID overall in society was handled in America. Why there would be a difference in a Republican versus Democrat judge as to a medication. I mean, I don't think Republicans versus Democrats do or don't like, you know, ibuprofen or penicillin or whatever else it is. But this, it's a political issue.
It's infuriating. I mean, politics has no business in healthcare whatsoever.
Of course
and,
not.
I mean, I barely voted the last election, and I mean, but now I'm cast as this right-wing conspiracy theorist, right? They just assume, you know, make all sorts of assumptions about me just because I believe in helping patients.
Yeah, I'll tell you something else about the practice of medicine. I'm sorry, any more questions, because we are near the end of time. And, oh, go ahead, please.
Thank you again for what you're going through. How can we support you?
Oh, thank you. I think just, you know, I don't know. Call your legislators, raise hell with the politicians. That's probably the best thing we can do right now.
Can people, I mean, average citizens have no input at the Texas Medical Board? Is that correct? I mean, what if they get in and,
you know, letters to the medical board might be helpful. Yes. but.
Well, you know, I do think this whole issue seems to be people in bubbles. And the people who were gonna push the vaccines and we're not gonna have ivermectin and we're not gonna have all the other things that might help people, they're in a bubble and they talk to each other and they think everyone thinks this. And then there are people who just are more, and they aren't, the bubble thing isn't fair, really, because what the other people are saying is, let's figure out what works. So let's see if doctors, because, I mean, this is the whole thing when Dr. Bartlett came on my show in July of 2020 and said, I know everyone's waiting for the vaccines, but I discovered something great. Mm-hmm. Inhaled budesonide works. And it was just honestly, you could kind of feel, even listening to him, that, you know, the fear was dropping as he spread that message. Mm-hmm. So people looking for truth versus people looking to, not just in the bubble, but they're actually spreading and they're reinforcing the regulatory takeover of the agency of the federal agencies by the pharmaceuticals. It's just a forced conclusion without thought.
Mm-hmm, right. It's safe. It's safe to follow the FDA and the CDC, right? No one's going to fault you for that. No one's going to, you know, report you to the medical board for following the CDC and the FDA.
That's and it's actually an answer to my earlier question about why don't all doctors do what you did, which is speak truth and pursue what you understood as a doctor, what was right. It's so much easier to go along mm-hmm. with what the FDA says. Mm-hmm. It's like, but you know, when you were little and your mother taught you, you know, don't go along with the crowd, think for yourself. I mean, honestly, in so many arenas of life, it's needed now more than ever. That notion, use your intelligence, your brave, your education, and think for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, Dr. Mary Talley Bowden, you are one brave woman. So thank you so much for, oh, you have another, okay. We have 10 seconds. You have a 10-second question?
Can we all just simply send to our doctors a copy of the Hippocratic Raw Oath?
Okay, we are out of time, folks. Mary Talley Bowden, again, thank you so very much for coming into America Can We Talk. Thank you for coming in. And my very fine friends, thank you also for tuning in to America Can We Talk every Monday through Thursday at 3 p.m. Central Time. I do this show to speak truth about America because America matters. And I will talk to you next time.
America Can We Talk? Truth